but I always get asked that question by a lot of founders who are at that early stage. They get so focused on the deck and they forget about just being themselves and talking about what they can do, but most importantly, you know, what they can't do. And here's what they're willing to try and help to kind of achieve their goal.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of the Entrepreneur Experiment Podcast with me, Gary Fox. This week, we're chatting to Jane Ronan from Tallyvest. She's the CEO and founder of Tallyvest, and she has had a remarkable journey. Jane's journey symbolizes what it is to be an entrepreneur, I think. I thought about this journey after we spoke, and often we look at entrepreneurs and think, oh my God, what a phenomenal, magical, unicorn type being they are, when in reality, they're grafters, they have consistency, and they have the self-belief to keep going when it might seem pretty bleak. Jane kept going, and her consistency is paying off with the success of Tallyvest. It's a really good story, and it'll show you the realities of being an entrepreneur. So it's a really good one. So look forward to that. I just want to say a quick thank you to my partners for season 7. First up, we have Find a Venue, Sean and his team at Find a Venue. If you are a corporate event organizer, you need to chat to them. It's as simple as that. There's no cost for using the service. So log on to findavenue.ie. Pop in what you're looking for, whether it's a conference, a Christmas party, a meeting, whatever it is, they have the full selection of, I'm going to say, almost every venue you want to be at in Ireland. Go check them out. I actually used to Find a Venue this week, met Sean. He's helping me set up the Entrepreneur Mastermind series for our private community on the Entrepreneur Experiment. So I can vouch for them. They are the business. Next up, we have Chapter. That is chapter.ie. They're a creative design studio based out of Cork. Deirdre and her team will help you with everything to do with your brand. So if you have an idea for a new brand and you're thinking, right, how do I get this from concept to reality? You need to talk to Chapter. Or if you have an existing brand and you have some budget to spend, they will help you refresh and rebrand the entire thing. They're incredible. Look forward to sharing some examples of their work in the coming weeks. We're going to talk about some of the rebrands and the new brands that they've worked on. So I'm looking forward to that. And finally, we have Baystreet.io. Baystreet Innovation, Gareth and his team, they are your technical partner. Think of them like that. If you're an entrepreneur and you're a non-technical founder, they can be your technical founder. They will help you bring your idea to reality from a technical point of view. Or if you're an SME and you have a huge amount of repetitive tasks in your business, Gareth and his team will find them, help you streamline them, and help you eliminate them using automation. It's an incredible process. Also going to get Gareth to talk to, I think, my private members community about how to do that for our own businesses. So I'm looking forward to that. Now, on to today's chat with Jane from Tallyvest. Jane, welcome to the pod.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining me. You're kind of all around Ireland at the minute.
I am. It's great. I feel quite homeless in many ways.
It's probably nice though.
It's great. Yeah. I mean, the way we like to see it is that we just have multiple homes in Lynch and Dublin and Cork. And, you know, we're very grateful. We have very nice friends and family who are just opening up their doors to us.
Life goals. Multiple homes.
Multiple homes.
Where's normal base for you and the company?
So normal base would have been Dublin. We were there for the last 5 years. At the moment, our new base is down in Cork. My accent probably has given it away. I'm a very proud Cork woman, and I'm really enjoying my time back in Cork. It's kind of, I guess, really highlighting the importance of having that kind of lifestyle balance, which is great. Whereas 2 years ago, I would have been in the States full time. So I've kind of done a bit of a 360 really in terms of where is my home. It seems to always be changing.
Okay, what had you in the States?
So we lived in San Francisco and then we lived in New York, which we loved. It was really great, brilliant energy. And we just took the decision then that it was time to come back. A lot of our customers were EMEA based and we wanted to focus our efforts there.
Okay, so the company actually started in the States.
It did. So this was pre-pivot. The original company was called Connect Again, which was an alumni relations platform system. And our very first customer was Stanford University.
Oh, wow.
And I originally went out there for 2 weeks, and 2 weeks turned into 2 months, and 2 months turned into 6 months. And absolutely loved it. It was a brilliant place to learn, really good place to get in front of decision makers and understand what works, what doesn't work. And I loved it. It was a really, really good environment there. But at this stage, there was only two of us in the company. We wanted to build a team. We wanted to, I guess, leverage our network that we knew best, which was back in EMEA. And we came back, and then we actually went back out again to New York. One of our investors very kindly gave us an office space there.
Oh, wow.
And again, it gave us a really good first-hand experience of understanding the market, the type of customers. So when it came to that alumni relations market that we were originally in, you know, we were very much experts on what worked, what didn't work, how to understand the best decision makers in the world when it came to the biggest universities and organizations. So definitely worthwhile, and it was great fun too.
We've skimmed through a lot of years there. We're going to go way back. Bring me back to Connect again. How did that all start? Was that your first venture, or how did that start?
So my first venture was actually a company called Your Yearbook. I started this when I was in my final year in university back in UCC with a friend of mine. And the plan was originally I was working for Dropbox. This was just meant to be a summer project. And I really, really loved my time in college, I guess. And I wanted to really just create a very traditional standard yearbook, but I didn't want to do it the traditional way because I was just quite limited on time. So we created this company called Your Yearbook. We didn't have a clue what we were doing, but loved every second of it. And we found out very quickly that we were collecting quite a lot of data on final year students. We knew where they were going. We knew how to get in contact with them. And our university liked that concept of that kind of alumni relations community piece. But unfortunately, in Ireland and a lot of Europe as well, it's not really celebrated, your alumni status, when you go through university in comparison to the bigger universities, you know, Stanford, Harvard, all the big ones. But we pivoted, I guess, their very first pivot, which was 7 years ago, from Your Yearbook to then Connect again. And
why did you pivot?
I think I kind of had a good feeling at that stage. At this stage, I had turned down the job in Dropbox. That was the first big kind of, oh shit, moment.
How did you do that? How did you decide?
It was actually quite easy. I'm very lucky, but my mum and dad started their own ventures, and our house was always, like a constant brainstorming session of ideas. And I don't know, I'm a big believer in just following your gut. And I think I'm probably overly too optimistic that I don't seem to see what's the worst that can happen. Now, obviously, to a certain degree, you have to think about that as well. But, you know, I kind of looked at it to kind of say that I was in the middle of doing a master's. I dropped out of the master's as well. And I always kind of felt, you know, if this doesn't work out, I'll just go back. Hopefully it'll be a great story to tell Dropbox. And they were great. And, you know, in many ways, this was when they were just setting up in Ireland. It would have been a really exciting time. But I just felt, look, let's see where the year goes. And 7 years later, here I am.
They're still waiting for you. They're like, any day now. She's going to come back any day.
I know. You'll get a random email. Remember me?
So Your Yearbook, what prompted you then to move in? You said you followed your gut, but was it like you couldn't see a revenue stream, or what was it to move to Connect again?
Like, I think it's probably a very good early lesson. You just have to listen to people and listen to, like, what's that kind of constant kind of common denominator that keeps being brought up. And I kept hearing, I guess, from a lot of our different users and our customers that, you know, once they gave us their data and they had their yearbook, you know, then it was like, how do we keep in contact? Mm-hmm. And one of the departments at UCC, the BIS department, which is kind of a business information system, kind of like computer science, they were hugely invested in this yearbook because up to that date, they didn't really have anything to keep up to date with their alumni apart from like a traditional Excel sheet. And I couldn't understand, you know, if I'm an alumni of UCC, number one, is it easy for me to donate back, which it wasn't. I didn't understand where the money was going to and what's in it for me. How do I get connected to Gary, you know, once I've left? And it was just really complicated. So I guess the BIS department kind of said, well, can we now actually have the data? Can we have the email addresses in the yearbook? And that kind of, I guess, in a way, started that little seed in my head, because I said, well, if BIS are having this, you know, challenge or thought process, maybe others are as well. But look, it was an uphill battle. I mean, I remember having it out with my university and many others over Europe because they wanted to go down the route of, well, we'd rather get your home address than your email address. And we don't want to move from the system we've had for 20 years to this system. You know, it was quite risk averse. And I think coming from a situation where I'd never done this before, I was so focused on, but you'll save time, you'll get better donations, you'll have a community, like, why? And I guess when I moved to the States, I loved it because they were so open to innovation. And the language they spoke in comparison to back home was completely different and motivating. And one of the best things we did was we hosted a conference in Ireland that, like, even to this day, I don't know how we pulled it off, but we got Qualtrics to pay for it. And they flew over the top alumni directors in the world. And we invited every single alumni director in Ireland. And it was amazing just listening to these top alumni directors speak about the importance of being data driven. And this was at a time where, again, that word wasn't really being thrown around much. And even then, I kind of was like, there's definitely something here. But I made the decision, I guess, very quickly that, am I in this for the next 10 years to kind of get from A to B? Or is there a way that I can go from A to Z within that time frame? So I felt doing just a yearbook was only one part of the puzzle. I felt, let's get involved in data and let's drive it from going from A to Z overnight rather than just seeing how much more that we can grow it.
I love the fact you hosted the conference. They're great hacks.
Oh, it's great. Yeah.
They're incredible. They're absolutely incredible.
Great one, yeah.
You're giving people something. You're not trying to sell them something. You're giving them an experience. You're giving them connections. You're giving them learnings. It's a genius strategy.
Yeah, but to be honest, it was brilliant because we wanted it to be quite an open forum. So, you know, it was a very safe environment. So a lot of the alumni directors could actually ask, you know, Rafe at Stanford, you know, how do you do what you do? Here's what we do. What do you think? Mm. And as long as, I guess, the attendees had the right attitude, it worked really well. So for us, it was definitely one of our most successful events. And, you know, in a way that kind of stemmed our thought process when we think about our company now when we do events, because we always try to do them a little bit unique because nobody wants to go to the same standard event all the time.
Yeah, it's fatigued.
I certainly
People
don't
are fatigued
anyway.
From events, yeah, especially remote events now, Zoom events, they're kind of fatigued from it.
Exactly. They're just a little bit, again, it's very, very much down to the personal opinion of it. But like our last event that we did when it was pre-COVID, we hosted it in a tiny cinema with a Tallyvest cocktail. And, you know, we had very interesting speakers and got everybody involved. And I think that's really important when you're trying to portray and I think educate a market as well on what you're doing, but most importantly, why are you doing it?
It says a lot about yourself as well. It says a lot about the company, how you host events. It says a lot about how you approach things. How did you jump from UCC to the States?
So again, I think a part of my learning, so I've never worked anywhere else but for myself. So I never, I guess, understood the do's and the don'ts. So I always liked the idea of just reaching out to anybody and everybody if I felt that they could help. So I reached out to the alumni director in Stanford when I was there, you know, didn't realize how high up the alumni directors actually are in these universities. I mean, they're huge decision makers there. I think he was probably so either captivated, I'd like to think, by my email from a random Irish girl, or the fact that I probably emailed him 10 times, both on LinkedIn and on email, that he said, okay, take the message, I take the meeting. And it was incredible. And all I needed was a validation to say, you're not mad, there's definitely something here. And then I got an introduction from him to somebody in Berkeley. And you, again, it's all about how do you leverage your network. Yeah. And I guess learning very early on, it's okay to ask for help and it's okay to say, actually, I don't really know what I'm doing, but what do you think?
Yeah, it's very, having that open mind, just to ask the obvious question, to ask the simple question that's like, how does that work?
Yeah.
And often people are like, oh, well, I'd love to tell you. You know, it's just being, we often are very scared to kind of go, oh, he's going to think I'm an idiot or he's going to think I don't know what I'm doing. So you went over on a 2-week fact-finding kind of mission, was it?
Exactly.
And
2 weeks.
Just stayed.
Yeah,
of course.
Just stayed.
Of course.
And well, you know what? It's a very special city in many ways. It actually does remind me of Cork. And obviously I'm going to be very biased because I'm from Cork, as a lot of us are. But there was such a lovely familiarity there. And there were so many Irish over there as well. And again, everybody's quite open in terms of like how they can help. You know, our very first round of investment, you know, the majority of our investors were from San Francisco. So that really helped as well. And there's something, I guess, when you're a young founder and your company's just starting, there's something hugely infectious about being around others.
Mm,
you think bigger, you're, you're going 100 miles an hour. I felt back in Ireland, you know, my friends were on different paths. You know, I was probably looked at as if I was a lunatic doing what I was doing. So it's, I think it's important at the very beginning to surround yourself and be absorbed in the what ifs and maybes, and, you know, instead of kind of thinking the whole time of, God, am I really doing the right thing here?
Mm, definitely. Yeah, that insecurity can kind of haunt you if you're sitting staring at the laptop all day, especially now. I think during COVID times, it's probably very important to get yourself tapped into a community. Like, that's what we try to do with the podcast, is to try connect people to kind of go, look, this is what's possible. Jane's in Cork. And if someone else is in Cork listening now, they'll be like, oh, amazing. That's such kind of a, I can do that. I know Jane. That's completely possible. So how did you kind of fund that adventure? Like, how did you keep going through the 2 weeks and then go, okay, I'm going to double down now here and stay?
Again, I think I thought the advantage that I was 24, I think. I didn't have a family. I didn't have a mortgage to worry about. So I had a lot of flexibility, I think, to kind of say, I want to keep pushing my trip and all that good stuff. We actually were in revenue at that stage with your yearbook. It wasn't a lot, but it was before we knew about cash flows or anything like that at all, which was great. And when we started Connect again, we originally did a program back in the UK. It was just kind of like a mini accelerated program, and we got some funding from that. And I kind of made that money last for as long as we possibly could. And again, without kind of saying it too cliche, but, you know, you do sleep on people's couches and you do find ways to kind of, again, get through it. I think we've always kind of, I particularly have always had that mindset of kind of staying lean. And again, the very first investment round that we did, we raised probably more than we needed to. But again, we raised it from some incredible angel investors. So again, we got to San Francisco, then we got our very first check out there. So you kind of have to self-fund that way.
So you raised a round in San Francisco?
Yep. So we raised our first round in San Francisco. And then what we did was we match funded that then with Enterprise Ireland, which was great.
Okay.
So that gave us a bit of, again, that further bit of runway. But I think, again, we probably went through every typical starter founder story, you know, which is you start with one idea and then by the end of it, it's something completely different. And we were quite fortunate in a way, because during all the pivots, we were making revenue. We had the ability to raise capital along the way at different valuations, because we were able to prove, you know, here's why we've pivoted. Most importantly, like, here's kind of those really successful KPIs that we feel are kind of giving it merit to get to the next stage. So we were quite fortunate that way, that we always kind of had that mindset that, again, it's okay to make mistakes. It's okay that you set out to do A, but actually it's going to be B. So I think we were always quite mindful of that. I think myself and my co-founder took the view that let's not be silly, let's not be irresponsible, but at the same time, let's still make sure we don't lose that kind of risk and innovation flair, because sometimes you have to be somewhere for things to happen. And I really do believe that.
It's a really good point, actually. What was it like raising in San Francisco? You know, you've just gone over there on a kind of fact-find mission, extended that out and then done a raise. Like, that sounds like quite a journey in a very, I'd imagine, short space of time.
Yeah, it was. I mean, again, I'm coming from a place where I think business is all about people. And again, if I could kind of go back and look at what I was doing back then, I'm sure I would change 101 things. But the one thing I wouldn't change is kind of the innocence of going in and kind of saying, I have this idea and here's why I think it's going to be successful. I never went in with the mind frame of saying, I'm going to reach, you know, $1 billion status in 2 weeks' time, and being totally unrealistic about things. And I really do believe kind of your seed round, it's not so much about the idea, it's about the founder, you know, how honest are they, you know, can they truly execute something? What are they learning? You know, what is that whole merit behind their idea? And I was quite picky about our investors at the very beginning, as I still am now, because I believe your investors are an extension of your team and your company, and it says quite a lot about the company and the founder. So we were, and it sounds great, but we did turn down quite a lot of capital at the very beginning. And again, just didn't have a very good feeling about it. But it gave me that opportunity to go and meet with investors that I felt not only could be in a position to write us our first check, but could really help us in those early days. And, you know, once we got one really good investor on board, that gave us that, you know, good bit of foundation to go to the next one. Now, I'm probably making that sound very easy.
Oh, you there are. Was, you are, yeah. Go back and give me the horror stories.
Oh, there was hundreds of them. And again, I never did. This is before we did Techstars. And we did Techstars when we pivoted. So this was, I had no training or I had no understanding of what is a successful investor meeting. And you can read things all you want. Yeah. You have to actually go and experience it and get the no's. And God, they're awful to get. And they're very difficult to not take personally. But again, you have to pick yourself back up and you have to go on to the next one. And that's the only mindset that I feel, you know, is so important, particularly for a founder. For every yes you get, there's going to be 90% no's beforehand or 95% of no's beforehand.
What were the key things you kind of learned in those early kind of meetings going, oh, I definitely should not be doing that? What are the kind of key things you think a successful entrepreneur does in that those early stages?
I think being Irish, we're very fortunate because I believe that we're very good storytellers. And one of the things I didn't do at the very beginning, which I would now always do, is you have to put yourself in that other person's shoes. So if they're listening to 20, 30 pitches or whatever it is, what's that one thing they're going to captivate? You know, do you want them to walk away saying that founder is fantastic? Do you want them to walk away and say that product is going to be huge? You know, what is that one message? At the very beginning of my journey, and I'll never forget, I remember meeting one or two top executives, I think in Facebook at the time, and one of them brought in their dog with them. And I was told, I think I was more interested in the dog. And I was trying to kind of get up more of a general conversation. Then I stopped myself and I went into pitch mode. And I could see that this guy was getting disinterested because he didn't actually understand what I was doing. What I should have actually done was create a relationship and say, can I tell you about what I'm doing and try and make it relatable?
Yeah.
In some shape or form. And sometimes you have to read a room, you have to read a situation, you have to trust your gut. So in many ways, when I look back at my early days, you know, you go straight into like, let me show you my deck slide by slide and let's read it together. And within the first 2 seconds, eyes are glazed over. Like nobody wants to read that at all. I think a lot of early investors are more interested in like, why you, like, where did you come up with this story? And I think I was quite lucky that the story was compelling enough that I was able to say, I've left a master's, I've left a job, I'm actually here sleeping on a friend's couch, but I really believe this is going to work. And I think being authentic and not bullshitting does work really, really well. Now, obviously, the different types of fundraising, it changes. But I always get asked that question by a lot of founders who are at that early stage. They get so focused on the deck, so focused on what they're going to do, and they forget about just being themselves and talking about what they can do, but most importantly, you know, what they can't do. And here's what they're willing to try and help to kind of achieve their goal.
That human connection, like, especially when you're so enthusiastic at the early stages, pitching to everybody, yeah, repeatedly, and people are going, whoa.
Exactly.
just having a coffee. I don't want to, like, see your slides. Put them away.
I think also, like, have a pair of balls, like, as well, in terms of, like, if you're having a good conversation. Obviously, I know it's not easy asking somebody for investment, but there's a way to do it or else your time is wasted. So there's always a way to say, you know, is this something you'd be willing to invest in or what are your thoughts? And at the start, I remember cringing now. You could spend 2 hours with somebody and you could be like, that's great. And I'll just email them afterwards to see if they're interested. And you've lost it then.
Yeah.
Like, you kind of have to capitalize on the meeting and be like, it seems like you're really interested. What do you think about coming on board? And just, nobody likes doing it at the very beginning, but you just have to go and ask the question.
It's great advice. I love that because Irish were very kind of like, sure, we'll see what'll happen.
Sorry, yeah. And we go in and we talk about the weather for 20 minutes and I particularly saw that in New York. It's not about like chit chat. It's like, what can I do for you? And that took me a while to get comfortable with. But as a result, I'd now be a lot more bullish, I think, as a result of it.
It's trying to blend the two, isn't it? Blend being sound with actually having the direct ask of going, okay, what are we going to do? When are we going to do it?
Exactly.
Yeah, so bring me through this journey. I'm trying to put the timeline together in my head as we're traveling along. So we're in San Francisco. You're raising funds yet or you're doing Techstars? Where are we now?
So we did San Francisco for about a year, and that was all around Connect Again, which was brilliant. And along that journey through that early piece of investment, we started to understand that a lot of the corporations that we were talking to were now all of a sudden asking us, well, it's fine about our alumni. Can you tell us, you know, why people are leaving in the first place? Oh. And again, I kind of got that very similar feeling that I did with your yearbook. I was like, this is interesting. So if people are willing to create alumni communities, surely they want to understand why people are leaving. Maybe that there's something there. So put back on my research hat, and I'm very good at bombarding people to get answers. And I just, again, went out, asked about, I think, 30 or 40 different executives at different companies. You know, do they know why people are leaving their organization? Is it very much the view of don't let the door hit you on the way out approach, or is it more kind of we're open to boomerangs? And it was very obvious that a lot of organizations have an ad hoc approach. They, you know, they might do a face-to-face interview, but we all know nobody's going to be really honest with you when it comes to that face-to-face. And a lot of HR departments, we're really losing precious time in doing mundane tasks rather than putting in action plans based on results. So I felt that there's definitely something here. But I wanted to do the pivot in a way that I felt comfortable with and supported with, because I had read and met a lot of different founders who had some horror stories when they were trying to pivot, because it can be pricey, you can make mistakes. So at this stage, I was 26, I think, or 27. And we went and we applied for Techstars London, which we got. It was in collaboration with Virgin Media. And it was really like 12 months packed into three when it came to trying to get a business out there. And it was incredible. We had, I guess, in many ways, the support and that kind of bandwidth of kind of saying, okay, who do you need to talk to? What do you need to build this product, and how can we prove that there's a market here as fast as possible? And really, within that 3 months, we got our very first customer. We built a small team. We proved that not only was there a market with exit interviews and gaining that analytics, but actually the market was going to be huge when it came to understanding each movement of that employee experience from the phrase beginning from onboarding all the way through to the end. And I could see it myself just from my own friends, you know, and where they were, that people weren't looking at their jobs as a job for life. They're looking at it as, what can I get out of this for the next 2 or 3 years and then move on, and et cetera, et cetera. So I felt that there was definitely a beat missing here. So after Techstars, we raised kind of, I guess, our follow-on funding. So we raised about $1 million. And that was from one institution and a couple of more angel investors. And that gave us, you know, quite a lot of movement over the last 2 years in going from building one product to now having a product offering of 5 different products. As I said, going from the very beginning, going to the very end, where we work with customers to predict churn in their organization, to telling them the problem areas, telling them how to, you know, improve their training and development. And what we're really trying to do is save HR huge time and expenditure and point them in the right direction, say, actually, here's where you need to focus, and giving leaders the data that they can actually stand over and say, okay, we are a great place to work. You know, here's the data. We actually know what our employees are engaged. We know if they're energized. We know when they're not energized. So giving them a whole visibility over their workforce, which definitely has been a journey, starting from just, you know, measuring that tiny piece of exit employee data.
So was it hard to, I suppose, switch gears again and go from, okay, we're going to leave the States and we're actually going to leave that whole kind of education sphere? Was that a difficult decision, or again, was it the gut?
Again, things actually happen quite fast. And like at the time, you don't really give it too much thought. You have, like, you know, for me, it was about where do we need to be in order to make this work? I felt that being in the States, it would limit us a little bit, because again, we weren't fully there. I felt that for us to make that transition there, we'd need a lot more funding, because again, it's, you know, it is hugely expensive over there in comparison to the UK or Ireland. So we kind of things just happened very, very fast. So all of a sudden we were, you know, in New York, and then all of a sudden we were in Techstars, and it just happened. And with Techstars, you know, we spent a lot of time actually over in the States with Techstars, from San Francisco and Boulder and then London. So you just have to move fast and just go with the opportunity. And it's only really kind of 6 months, 9 months after Techstars that we had to kind of come together and say, okay, where is the most, you know, beneficial place for this company to to grow. We do have global ambitions. You know, we do want to have a team over in the US. We do want to have, you know, several more offices. But I think to really give us that really strong foundation, we made the call that actually back in Ireland and taking advantage of, you know, all the fantastic companies that are here and growing that out was our best move.
What attracted you to Techstars?
So I spent a lot of time looking at different accelerators. We originally had applied for the Y Combinator and we got through to the final round. In many ways, I think it was great that we didn't get through to the final round because there's hundreds of companies actually in a Y Combinator slot. I think originally I thought that it was kind of 10.
Yeah, I thought the same, yeah.
Yeah, they have loads of companies, and for your demo day, you have to actually get through another round to even present on demo day. And now again, it is an incredible program and their alumni speak for themselves. But the other one that, again, it's very much coming down to like, what do I need at an accelerator? Of course, you want a YC stamp, but actually it's kind of irrelevant if your company's not there anymore. So for us, it was looking at, okay, we need a network. We need an accelerator that's got global reach. They have an investor network. They can actually help us build some of the product because, again, we were a team of four, I think, or three. And Techstars ticked a lot of those boxes. And we went for the interview again. You know, I think there was like 8 interviews, and we were at the time the only Irish company that got through, the only female company that got through. And as I said, you know, it's intensive. You either sink or swim. That's what they say to you on day one. You know, they expect results. They don't. You know, it's a very different accelerator program to some because they don't talk you through accountancy and kind of basics. You're kind of expected to know these things, or they provide you with funding to go and purchase those things. Mm. It is all about what customer has bought this, what metrics can you prove? And that's the way it should be.
Yeah, absolutely.
To be quite honest, you know, so when I hear a lot of founders talking to me about that, they spend the majority of their time doing pitch decks or building their website and building their product, I'm kind of saying, no, what you need to do is get in front of a customer.
Yeah.
Get them to tell you, would they buy this? That's a lot more valuable to show somebody or an investor than saying, look at my beautiful website or look at my beautiful product. We made that mistake at the very beginning. We spent so much time building our product and improving it and building this feature, and we had no validation actually of if that's what our customer wanted. And I think that's where a lot of founders need to really just press the pause and bring it back to who actually wants this.
That's unbelievably good advice. Like, that's, you see that so many times. Entrepreneurs get obsessed with like the website and the brand and the font and the color. It's going to be blue. Yeah. What shade of blue? It has to be a certain type of blue. It has to be this color.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter really. It doesn't, that's a 1% kind of stuff, and they avoid the 80%, which is really only, are people buying it? Is that
exactly
it? Who's and bought it? How much? Yeah. How often?
Exactly.
And it's look, scary though, right? It's scary.
It is. And I think that's probably where we go into our comfort zone. And I think unfortunately, being a founder and starting a venture yourself, you have to be outside of your comfort zone a lot more than you need to be in your comfort zone. Because the minute you're too comfortable, you stop growing, if that makes sense. So I think for that particular early stages, and again, we go through it the whole time. When we get you comfortable, we're like, okay, something needs to happen here.
I love that. That's much easier said than done though, right?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. And it's not easy at all. And I think every company goes through different growing pains, and ours at the moment is, you know, thankfully our company is growing. You know, our customers really love what we're doing. They're a part of our journey with us, particularly around our product roadmap. But one of our big pillars is rock the customer. So we're absolutely driven by customer needs. But at the same time, we're also very into creating what we think the market's going to want, particularly in a post-pandemic world. You know, whatever guidebook or rule book there was when it came to HR analytics has been thrown out. It's brand new. And we're at an advantage, we feel, because we're smaller than our competitors. We can build faster. We can kind of be a little bit more scrappier as well. But our customer relationships have always been number one. It's something that we're trying to scale. It's difficult to do that when you are a small team. So we're trying to expand our team at the moment, and that's difficult. It's a good growing pain to have, but it's also difficult when you can't meet somebody face to face and you're trying to get a feel for a person and all that good stuff as well. But I think at every stage of a company, I think you just need to have an honest conversation with yourself and be like, it's never going to be straight road. That's just not... I guess, part of the journey.
Yeah, perfection is the enemy of good, yep. Isn't it? The rules are gone, right? We don't know. No one knows what they're doing. As a founder, yeah. You never know what you're doing anyway. And now you definitely don't know what you're doing. How do you navigate that uncertainty, Jane? Like, how do you get up today and go, okay, not sure what's going to happen in 3-6 months, but I'm going to chart a course anyway. How do you get over that in your head?
I don't think you ever do, to be honest. Like, I'm always amazed about how quickly things can change. How, I mean, it's quite scary. You see big companies that can be brought to its knees in a week. You know, things just, like, you're never safe, really, I guess, is the message I'm trying to get across. You know, no matter how big your next fundraise is or whatever the case is, like, if you're not thinking 2 or 3 steps ahead, you're dead in the water, you know? And that is difficult sometimes, because sometimes you just want to be able to get up and be like, I just want to have a break. I want to be able to think about, you know, what does the next year look like and brainstorm and everything. And as a founder, unfortunately, you do have multiple hats the whole time. Obviously, at a certain stage, it gets easier that you can start delegating. But that is really difficult. And I think the pandemic for us was a really scary time. You know, we let go of some of our staff. We absolutely, like, leaned back as much as we possibly could, scaled everything, because the uncertainty was just completely unknown. And for a small company, you know, that was scary. I can't imagine what it must have been like for a big multinational company when, again, it's so unknown. What I find really, really valuable, and what I've always kind of seemed to have done, is that, you know, I do believe in visualization. I do believe in reminding yourself, not on a daily basis, but, you know, having a check-in once a week to be like, why do you do what you do? You know, I'm not saying every morning I get out of bed and run to my desk. Of course I don't. But, you know, for the majority of the time, I do love what I do, because you're thinking the whole time, you challenge yourself the whole time. But you have to have an end goal, of course. I mean, you know, as I keep saying to a lot of founders, it's like being in a car and you're just driving around, you need that destination. So for me, you know, I do have those goals. I do have to look back on them every kind of couple of weeks, because if you don't remind yourself of why are you doing this, where do you want to get to, years will fly and life is so short. And I, you know, again, that's another interesting conversation I would have with a lot of founders. Do it for the right reasons. Don't do it because you think it may work, or, you know, you think it's a good thing to do. You have to have that right mindset. And that's something that I think every founder works on. And the majority of founders that I would chat to, they would always either have a mentor in their lives or they'd have a life coach. Mm. And that's so important, because you actually have to take that break and have that support from somebody, at least.
How do you, touched on it a little bit there, how do you plan, you know, your week, month, quarter, and set those goals? Do you have a specific process, or kind of bring us through that?
So again, it very much changes. So I know my strengths, which, again, I have no problem putting up my hand and saying, here's what I'm absolutely shite at, but here's actually what I'm very good at. Mm. So my co-founder and myself, we are very much the yin to the yang. So she looks over product. Laura would have come from kind of 20 years experience as a HR director. So she is our persona in many ways. So she is fantastic to be leading the product side of things. So I don't really go near the product with Laura. We talk about more high level. And, you know, I then would be very much focused on sales and marketing. So again, I like to kind of feel that I'm getting all the information, putting it back to Laura, and they're coming up with ways and how do we solve this. The problem with the startup is that no matter how organized you are by quarter, things are going to change. A customer is going to throw something in there that wasn't planned. It changes every quarter. We try to stick to our goals as much as we can. I feel what's really important is, well, for us anyway, we hire for talent on our team. The skill set is really important, obviously, in their experience. What we want to make sure is that somebody can come in and they're a self-starter. They don't need to be handheld. They don't need me to approve 20 different tasks. I just need them to go and think and, I guess, trust in a way that they're making the right decision. So a lot of, say, marketing, our head of marketing, Aisling, you know, her experience is amazing. So she'll come with a plan and she'll say, here's what I want to achieve this quarter. All I want to know is what you need for me. You know, I trust you implicitly to kind of go and do what you think. I'll come up with ideas and we merge them together. But I think, again, one of our big questions that we ask, you know, every single quarter when we think about it, when we start the new year, is what number do we want to end up with at the end of the year? And what are we missing to get that number? Because again, no matter how enthusiastic you are, there's only so much you can do in your day. And we have a culture where we do not believe in burnout. In fact, we're shutting down the company in August for a whole week. It's mandatory. Everybody's taking it off to have that time to just reboot, because it's a really busy time for us at the moment. So we don't want to have that environment, because I feel that if somebody's stressed, the customer will eventually find that they'll actually feel that the company's under pressure and stressed. So we like to not kind of jam pack too much into the year. We'd like to look at it, say, what are the big things that need to happen? What's that number at the end? And then we work backwards to kind of see, will that make a difference on the number? Because again, you can look at your product roadmap and say, let's do this, let's do that. And actually, it actually could be totally irrelevant. That customer or that base there, they actually don't need that. It's just being distracting. So I guess to answer your question, it's something you have to look at the whole time, but look at that number at the very end.
And then is there a specific way you line out your week or your day, or does that, I know with COVID, it's a very hard question to answer. Typically, how do you kind of plan your week or day?
So I would be a big believer again in that lifestyle balance. And I think for a long time, I almost feel like founders wanted to wear this badge of honor that they survived off beer and pizza and worked around the clock. And look, of course, that's important. We've all been there. We've all done that, particularly in the textiles days. But is it sustainable? No. Does it make you happy? For me, it didn't make me very happy. I wanted to make my company work for me and my lifestyle. So things that are really important to me are my fitness, my health, my friends, my family. So I did do quite a lot with a career coach about 2 years ago, and I'd have check-ins to kind of look at my week and say, well, where can my energy, you know, be spent? So I focus my week on, you know, which I would start on a Sunday night and say, okay, what are the big things I need to get done? And it doesn't need to be 10 big things. It could be one big thing. And that's how I focus. So again, my focus is always on customer and marketing. So I look at what demos do we have coming up, what check-ins do I need to do, make sure that, again, is there anything big coming up with the tech team this week that we need to go and have a brainstorm on? But I always make sure that there's time for breaks. So I'm an early riser, so I'd work from, say, 7 till maybe 1. I need to take an hour or two off, so I'd go for a run. I'd come back then, and then I would look through what's coming up for the next day. So there is a method to the madness there. It's something that I am working on the whole time. I think when you're fundraising, it's completely different. It's not something that I particularly enjoy doing. I don't think any founder does. But it's the one time that your focus is actually just completely on fundraising and you're away from the company. It's something that I know we're going to get ready to be doing at the end of the year. So at the moment, my big focus is on how much closer can I get us to that number that we're looking to achieve at the moment.
And what's then, you kind of outlined it there, maybe a potential fundraise at the end of this year. What's the kind of next 6 to 12 to 18 months hold for the company?
So at the moment, we're still very much focused on customer growth. We are, you know, extremely busy, which is great. I think the opportunity in the HR analytics market is just expanding faster than it ever has before. We're trying to grow in a way that's not, I guess, putting us under pressure. We want to grow in a way that we'll actually have a permanent stance with new customers. A lot of our growth comes from recurring revenue, comes from a lot of different contract growth. We work with a lot of different multinationals, so we want to land and expand. That takes quite a lot of time. What we want to be able to kind of achieve in the next 6 months is we've rolled out a brand new product with development and training. So it's helping now a new persona in the company, which would be the learning and development officers, in identifying kind of key skill gaps, helping them assign courses to actually tackle what that challenge is, rather than just saying, here's a LinkedIn license and you can choose from any of the 4,000 or 5,000 courses. So it's saving that time. Once we achieve that, then we will do a fundraise. We now feel that we're ready and we're strong enough to expand the team in areas that we haven't before. So, you know, very much now looking at a bigger sales team, a bigger marketing team. We have a lot of customers now over in the US. So, you know, we're now looking at dipping our toe into that, understanding what do we need. But at the same time, we don't want to grow too much because we don't want to jeopardize what we've built over the past years. We want to be able to kind of, I guess, walk before we sprint.
Okay, that all makes sense. Exciting times. How do you feel HR will have evolved? How do you think with remote work and everything like that, is the industry changing?
Yeah, and like, to be honest, I think the HR departments are the most important at the moment. And they're also the departments, unfortunately, that, you know, probably don't get as much support as they need. As I said earlier, the rule book and the guidebook that existed for the last, you know, whatever, a couple of years, you know, it's completely gone. It's not reflective of this new workforce. And I can only imagine what a HR director has to think about every day, from, you know, how do you bring training and development that used to be in-house, face-to-face, online? How do you justify licenses for any e-learning provider? You know, how do we know if somebody's engaged at home? How do we know if an onboarding that was virtual, was that effective? And all these data points tell their own story. So it's not a nice-to-have product. This is a crucial, you know, product that any organization needs, because they're trying to manage a new world that has never existed before. And I think we're in a time where the workforce want to have a voice. They want to give feedback. They want to be heard. And I think organizations need to listen to that. So where I get really excited about is, you know, I'm a big believer in survey fatigue. Nobody likes answering loads of surveys. So we want to try and be innovative and say, well, how can we make it, you know, an enjoyable experience for the end user? You know, instead of them kind of saying, OK, here we go, 2 hours and I'm locked away in a room and I need to be answering yes or no. We want to bring that to a whole new level. And again, it's you know, we hate hearing stories from HR departments where their day is, you know, spent either trying to come up with questions, trying to become a data scientist themselves, going through data. They shouldn't be doing that at all. They should be looking at how do we implement like new strategies, new ideas on how to make people engaged. So I think it's going to be a really different world for a lot of organizations. And I hope organizations will adapt and thrive. But unfortunately, we are seeing some organizations that they're just snapping back to the way that it was. And
that's
the
danger, isn't it?
It is. And at the moment, particularly in the US, it is like people are leaving faster than ever before. Like the exits are just on the rise.
That's super interesting. Is that coming because people are going, being told you got to come back and do it the old way? And they're like, nah.
I think it's a mixture. And I mean, you know, I'm sure we can all relate that in the pandemic, you have quite a lot of time to yourself. So I'm sure a lot of people were looking at their life being like, oh, am I really happy in this job? You know, when I was working 70 hours a week, did I really want that? So I think it was probably a wake-up moment for a lot of people. And you're right, I'm sure there was a lot of conversations to be had to say, either I want to work half-time at home or half in the office. And if your boss really said, well, sorry, we want you 5 days a week in the office, they said, well, that's fine, I'm gone. You know, so I'm sure there's a lot of different variations going on to the way the exit has increased.
Cool. I have two final questions before we go. The last one is to ask you to recommend a book that's kind of made an impact on you personally or professionally. And the second last one is, what would you tell Jane if she's starting off again? She's back, starting with the very first version, my yearbook. What would your bit of advice to her be?
Do you know what? I've been asked that question so many times and it never gets easier.
No, because it's the toughest one. It's the hardest one to talk to yourself. Yeah.
So a book, I guess, business or personal?
Either or both, whichever.
I'll give you two. So,
excellent.
So my favorite personal book is a book called Red Notice. It's a brilliant book called by Bill Broder. I'd really recommend it. And it's a nice break from a business book as well. Mm-hmm. And the best business book is a biography all about the Nike founder called Just Do It. And I've gifted this book, I cannot tell you how many times. I just love it. And you come away from it feeling energized, but also, you know, it gives you a really nice insight into actually what does happen when something doesn't go right. And you look at these big brands and kind of feel, God, I was such an overnight success. And it's not at all. So I'd give that book to so many different early founders and I love it. I would read it about once or twice a year. It's really good.
Super. Jane, where can people learn a little bit more about the company and yourself?
So we are tallyvest.com and we've just actually launched our new website today.
Brilliant. So, go check it out.
Yes. So yeah, there's a lot about the company there, about what we do. how we work with different organizations. So definitely have a look at it if we can help any organizations out there with their employee experience. And that's probably the best location for us.
Who's your kind of ideal customer if people are listening and they're like, oh, I wonder, is that me? Who uses your platform?
So we have customers ranging from all sizes, from, say, a Cairn Construction, which would be about 300 employees, to an Intel contract with obviously multiple of thousands of employees. So it's really for somebody out there that's trying to understand, you know, why does somebody leave the company? You know, what does an engagement survey actually mean? How can we understand what motivates our employees? And typically somebody who's now ready to move from, say, using a SurveyMonkey type of tool, or they just use a Great Place to Work survey once a year, to now having more of a, they want more of a pulse on their employees to understand throughout the year how engaged their workforce is.
Savage. Jane, thank you so much for taking the time.
Absolutely. Delighted to.
That was my chat with Jane. I hope you enjoyed it. It was a really good one. She's a fantastic entrepreneur. I look forward to hearing more from her. So it's Talivest if you want to check them out. And I will be back here with you next Monday for the Idea Lab. In the meantime, go to my website, mrgaryfox.com, mrgaryfox.com. Join the newsletter. I send out a newsletter every week with just insights, information, and behind the scenes kind of stuff. I'm also on YouTube. You can check that out over there. Just search Gary Fox. I will see you back here on Monday. Have a great weekend.